Welcome to Film Fragments, a podcast where we take fragments of an actor, director, and genre and tell you our favorites from their catalog. My name is Brian Suffield. I'm your host, and I'm super excited to welcome you guys to this week's episode of Film Fragments, where today we're going to be talking about our favorite horror comedies. This is a very interesting topic to talk about. I'm super excited to be going through this foray of films to choose from, films that scare us, but also make us laugh hysterically. I cannot wait to talk about these films with all of you. And speaking of greatness, I'm super excited to welcome today's guest. So let me pull up the notes that I wrote about this person. Okay, so she is a news editor at Collider. She is a Cherry Picks approved critic. She is the co-host of Does It Get the Pass, a rom-com podcast. She's also the CEO of Frank Castle. I have no idea what that means, but I'm going to let it slide. I'm so excited to welcome Maggie Bocella to Film Fragments. Hi, Maggie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm super excited to be talking to you today about this particular topic.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on horror comedies. It was how I was introduced to the world of horror, which is something that's been kind of a tentpole in my entertainment education. So I'm very excited to talk about my picks because I like to think they're pretty niche.
I am super excited to hear them. But before we get into hearing about them, I like to throw a curveball question at the start of these episodes. So you're given the opportunity to pitch your dream horror comedy. You get to pick who directs it and who stars in it. You get to pick two actors max. Who would you pick to star in it and who would you pick to direct it?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I'm not as good with directors, but actor-wise, I'm going to cheat a little because I just interviewed Freddie Prinze Jr. for his own podcast. That was pretty scary, and we talked about him wanting to do more horror past I Know What You Did Last Summer, which came out in the 90s. So I think I'd pick him and, oh, goodness. I'm going to cop out because his picture's on my desk. John Bernthal, because I would love to see him in something scary. I like to think maybe they could play, like, you know, suburban dads in a slasher. You know, you don't get to see many older characters in slasher films. It's usually just teenagers. And, oh, director, man. I'm terrible with directors, but
it could literally be the most obscure pick ever. It could literally be the most obscure pick ever.
I think I'm going to go with, I cannot remember their names individually, but Radio Silence, which is the collective that directed the last two Scream movies, because I loved Ready or Not, which was the film they did before Scream, and I love a good modern horror, so I think that's the duo I go with.
Okay, that's a great, great pick. That's a great pairing. I would definitely watch that in a heartbeat. Oh, man, this is really tough for me because there are so many actors that I could choose that are obviously prevalent in horror comedies, but I could also pick actors who had never done horror comedies before that I would just love to see in these kinds of films. So I'm going to cheat. I'm going to literally choose the man that I call daddy. I'm going to choose Oscar Isaac to star in a horror comedy. Now, his co-star, this is really challenging because I could literally go any route with this. I could literally pick anybody for this. But you know what? I want to do a nice reunion of father and son. So Oscar Isaac as the dad, Timothy Chalamet as the son. I want that to happen. And the person to direct it, I am going to say, oh my God, how you pronounce her name? Oh my God, the woman who just directed, oh my God, Mimi Cave, who just directed Fresh. I want to see them work with her. I want to see them work with her.
Yes.
You know, you brought modern horror, and I was thinking of the same thing. And Fresh, while not on my list, that's one of my favorite horror comedies in recent memory. Even though I don't know if I would consider it a comedy, but it's definitely darkly funny. But yeah, I would definitely pick that. And plus, I want to see Oscar and Timothy work together again. Like, that would be a dream of mine.
Yeah, where Oscar doesn't bite it. I'd love to see Oscar survive a horror movie because it seems like he dies in quite a few things.
Could we get another movie where he's just laying in a chair fully nude? Please, could we get that again?
Please, female gaze, please. I would love to see that.
We need that so badly. So, you know, going into a little bit about yourself, talk a little bit about what got you into film, why you love it so much. What's your journey with film? What's Maggie's story?
So It's funny, about a month ago, my mom and I realized we were watching television and an ad came on for the Oscars, and my mom said to me, "Oh, the first time you ever walked was during the Oscars." You know, I was maybe a year and a half old, so I've always grown up around film. You know, my dad would take me to the movie, me and my brother to the movies every other weekend, and so it's kind of just been ingrained in kind of the spirit of who I am, because I was never a sporty kid. My brother was never a sporty kid. My mom was always really, really into supporting the arts and getting us into the arts. And so she would take us to see movies. She would show us movies on a truly massive VHS collection. So film has always been sort of ingrained in my existence, thanks to both of my parents, both my mother and my father. And then as you get older, you know, there are certain tent poles that you have to see, you know, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, that kind of thing. So I grew up in a generation that I was super lucky to have not only an incredible amount of film coming out when I was a kid, you know, the kind of a renaissance of Disney films, but also, you know, I had this whole backlog of 80s and 90s films, specifically horror comedies. You know, I was maybe watching things that were a little too young or a little too old for me. You know, I remember being 5 years old at my grandmother's house in Philadelphia, being upstairs in the guest bedroom that had a television that didn't have a remote. You had to physically switch the channels on the dial on the television, and it was black and white and it barely worked. And I remember flipping through trying to find like PBS Kids or something on a Saturday and coming across the 2005 remake of House of Wax and just sitting there kind of mesmerized by the opening sequence until, like, you know, wax melts away and it's a dead body under there. And then I was like, nope, bye. But, you know, I remember that because that was one of the first times I ever remember encountering scary things and being kind of morbidly obsessed with it. You know, I've always loved Halloween, both the movie and the holiday. You know, I've always been into sort of weird stuff. And one of the, you know, one of the big tenets of movies growing up for me was the Addams Family films with Christina Ricci in them. So that was always sort of part of my existence. But and then obviously coming into adulthood, I went to college. I got a bachelor's degree in communications. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. And then my senior year, like second semester, right before COVID hit, I decided, oh, I want to be a journalist. And so I kind of held out for a year and a half-ish, and now I'm working at Collider, and I've gotten to talk to a bunch of incredible people involved in film, and I've gotten to review a bunch of film, and it feels right being where I am right now.
No, I'm so happy that you're at where you're at. I love your work so much. Everything you do over at Collider is just so exciting. It's so unique, and, you know, not to mention the word that was mentioned before, but it's very fresh, and that's very exciting. No, that's great. That's great. It's so funny that you bring up a story of trying to watch TV at your grandparents' house and you come across House of the Wax. When I was a kid, I was trying to change the channels on my grandparents' television. And I came across, I was about, I think, 6 years old. I came across The Rain, and it was literally the sequence where she crawled out of the TV. And I'm like, well, I'm going to have nightmares for the next 2 weeks, so thanks. Yep. Thanks, Grandpa, for that.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I feel like the early 2000s was, you know, that kind of 2005, 2006 era was very much an era of a lot of horror, both, like, sort of imported horror, like The Ring, but it was also sort of the gore porn renaissance, so mm-hmm. There was a lot of stuff out there to really traumatize little kids if they came across it on television.
Absolutely. And, you know, to go into a little bit about our topic, you know, you hinted at a little bit before of why you love horror and comedies and everything, but why specifically did you want to come on today and talk about this particular genre? Obviously, horror films are very big. Obviously, comedies are very big. But combining the two together is a massive challenge that could really make or break a film. So why do you get excited whenever you see a horror comedy is coming out?
I love horror. I love, like I said, all things scary. I'm a very spooky person naturally. But I'm also kind of a bit of a wimp. You know, I don't love a lot of gore. I can't do David Cronenberg. It's you know, so there are certain things about really kind of hardcore horror that I can't mesh with. I get nightmares, whatever. So horror comedy was, for one thing, it was really as a teenager my entry point into horror, because I remember watching, I will mention later, one of the movies on my list with my dad, and it was the first time that I'd ever watched something that was scary, but it was a horror comedy, so it was still sort of accessible in that sense. And now I gravitate towards them both to avoid the sort of, you know, general kind of body horror gore things that seem to be popular with stuff like Infinity Pool and you know, movies like that coming out. But also, I love a comedy. You know, I grew up on a lot of Disney movies. I grew up on a lot of funny movies. I grew up on the MCU. You know, Iron Man came out when I was 10 years old. And so comedy is something that is kind of just, I've always intrinsically been drawn to. And horror comedies in general, much more so than a standard horror film, tend to have a bit more of a happy ending. So not always, but sometimes they do. And it's, so it's, or at least a more neutral ending. And I am, to quote one of my favorite television shows, a big fan of the happy kissy ending. So I kind of, I generally gravitate towards things that have a happier ending, whether that is a horror comedy or maybe, I guess, psychologically, that's probably the reason I love A Final Girl so much. I just like seeing someone make it out alive. I think that's why I mentioned Ready or Not. That's why I love that movie so much. So,
yeah, I mean, like I told you at the top, I'm not a huge horror guy. Like, horror is very hit or miss for me. I think the thing for me is that I just don't really get scared by all these horror movies. And the thing is, when I was growing up, you know, as someone who was born in 98, and, you know, my generation was very much in line with the, what I call the crappy mainstream horror, Insidious and all these other movies that just, when I watched them, I was expecting the scariest thing in the entire world. Like, they would emphasize to me, it's the scariest fucking movie ever made. And I'm like, all right, let's simmer down. Let's see how Brian feels about it. And then I would watch it. This didn't terrify me one bit. It didn't creep me out or anything. But then as I got older, I started appreciating horror way more than I ever could have imagined. And even though it's still one of my least favorite genres, I still love going out to watch a horror movie whenever they come out. And the thing that I love the most is, you know, having the time of my life, being thrilled and on the edge of my seat. But I also love to laugh. I love a good comedy. I love to have a good time. I love it. I love it so much. So Goodbye and the Chew, like I said, it's a very hard thing to do. When you're blending multiple genres, it's a challenge and it's very hard to pull off. But in my opinion, there's a lot of really strong horror comedies out there. And putting together this list was definitely not easy. This was really not an easy list because there's so many to choose from. But I am pretty confident to say that I'm satisfied with my list. I'm excited to talk about these films because they do scare me in some sense, but they also really, really make me laugh, which is what I look for in a horror comedy. If it doesn't scare me or make me laugh, or both of them, then it failed tremendously. These five films that I'm going to put on my list today, and I'm sure the five films that you're going to mention today, checked everything off. It was a good horror movie, good comedy, just combined the two together. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a little more, I like, my personal opinion of horror comedy is more that I'm not so much looking to for it to be funnier than it is scary. I mostly enjoy them because I enjoy that the comedy kind of pulls the scares back a bit.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't, there's nothing less intense, but, you know, the comedy kind of cuts it. And because comedy and horror are kind of juxtaposed in that way, that comedy, in a horror comedy, you know, that comedy comes in to cut the fear. And I think it can be, in the best of horror comedies, a really effective tool to cut the fear you're feeling only to really, really ramp it up and, you know, scare the living shit out of you when you're least expecting it. I think that's, a couple of the movies on my list are really, really good at effectively using that as a technique. And I think some horror comedies get it right, some don't, but, you know, I will take anything that the genre will give me, frankly, you know, so long as I'm not gonna come crying out of the theater, so.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder if any of the films that you have made you cry somewhat, but we'll have to see when we get into our list. So let's get right into our top five favorite horror comedies of all time. So Maggie, what is your number five favorite horror comedy of all time?
My number five film is the 1987 film The Lost Boys, directed by Joel Schumacher, starring Jason Patrick, Corey Haim, Corey Feldman, and Kiefer Sutherland. It is probably the scariest of the films on my list. It is, and probably the least funny as well, but, you know, generally, I did ask a couple people, would you consider this a horror comedy? And they said, yeah, mostly because of the Frog Brothers, who are played by Corey Feldman and Jameson Newlander. They're these 12, 13-year-old vampire hunters in Santa Carla, California that, you know, think they have everything set up. Corey Feldman's character believes himself to be a bit of a Rambo. But I think this one really spoke to me because I always joke that my mom and I love it for the same reasons. That reason being that we both had a crush on Billy Worth, who's the dark-haired vampire in the gang. And I didn't realize that until very, very recently when I did a bit of press for the 4K release of the film. And that's just, you know, when you realize that you've had the same crush on a character as your mom, it's a little weird. But this film, I remember watching probably when I was 13 or 14. This was around the same time. This was around the time when I was getting into horror, really, where I was kind of stepping away from being too scared to watch anything to really try something. And I remember my mom recommending this because, you know, she loved it. She graduated high school in 1984, so she was sort of really in the trenches for all of the great films that came out in the 80s. And like I said, this one's a little scarier. You know, it follows this family who moves to, you know, this coastal town in California only to realize that the local punk group is made of up of vampires. And ironically, I saw What We Do in the Shadows before I saw this film. And if you've ever seen What We Do in the Shadows, which is another great horror comedy, they rip off a bit from The Lost Boys, which is the bit where Kiefer Sutherland's character is trying to convince Jason Patrick's character to kind of entice him to become a vampire. And they try to feed him Chinese food. And Jason Patrick looks down at the Chinese food and it's made of worms. What We Do in the Shadows makes fun of that. So I remember watching this film for the first time and thinking that was hilarious. It's not supposed to be a funny bit. You know, it's not supposed to be inherently funny. But this film, like I said, there's comedy built in there, but it's mostly what I would refer to as situational comedy. Like, I don't think this is trying expressly to be a horror comedy. A lot of it is, you know, situationally, Corey Haim, Corey Feldman, Jameson Newlander are playing 12, 13-year-olds. I'm not sure how old they were at the, you know, time this film was made. But, you know, there's a line that I always joke about when Jason Patrick, who gets half turned into a vampire about a chunk of the way through the film, comes back and his little brother realizes it, and he's in his, Corey Haim's in his bathrobe going up the stairs, and he goes, "My own brother, a goddamn shit-sucking vampire. Wait till mom finds out about this." And it's, I don't know if that was intended to be funny, but it's one of those lines that just reads hysterically. And then you get to the end of the film, obviously, and the grandfather who this family has moved in with, it turns out he's known that there are vampires all along. You know, he drove his car into the side of the house, and he just kind of comes home, he opens the door, and he's like, "These goddamn vampires." And it's just, it's one of those things that cuts through all of the horror, because this is one of those films that very early on gave me an appreciation for special effects makeup, because the special effects makeup, you don't see it a ton on the vampires, you know, on Billy Worth and Alex Winter and Kiefer Sutherland, but the last half of the film, you know, when they have the sort of really accentuated brow bones and the contact lenses in and everything, and obviously the vampire fangs, it was so fascinating to me as a young kid, because I was just getting into Rick Baker, who was, you know, the king of special effects, and Tom Savini, and Tom Savini is actually from quite close to where I live. I live right up the road from his makeup school. So that was a thing that really drew me in. But I have always been and will always be a vampire girl. So this film really spoke to me there. And I think it was also hitting at the time when I was a 13, 14-year-old and I was angsty, you know. So these aren't like Dracula vampires. They're not the classic sort of, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, Gary Oldman style vampires. They were cool. They were hip. They wore leather all the time. You know, they had motorbikes. They had long hair. I still want the outfit that Alex Winter's character wears. It's this like super bedazzled, painted on jacket. And I'm dying for one. And one day when I have a lot of money, you know, from being an entertainment journalist, I will commission somebody to make me that and Sarah's ball gown from Labyrinth. But, you know, that's an aside. But yeah, I think this one made my list mostly because it was foundational for me. You know, The Lost Boys has always been and will always be, you know, one of my favorite movies, bar none.
That's a great pick. That's a very good pick. Unfortunately, it did not make my list. I haven't seen this film in, oh my God, it's been so long since I've seen this movie. And I remember watching it being like, hey, this is pretty good. This is a pretty good vampire movie. And, you know, a few years ago, I didn't give a damn about the vampire genre because Twilight was stuck in my brain. So I'm like, no, I don't care about the vampire genre. But this is a pretty good film. Pretty good stuff. Man, Corey Feldman, like, was in literal 80s banger after banger. Oh, Goonies, yeah. Stand By Me, and this. It's like, oh my god, that's like three great films back to back. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Oh, man. What a great track record. No, that's a great, great pick. I love that pick very much. And, you know, it's funny that you bring up Rick Baker. It's so good that you brought him up. Because my number five is a film that he worked on. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he won an Oscar for, if I'm not entirely sure. I could be wrong. I should have fact-checked this long beforehand. But my number five is An American Werewolf in London, directed by the great John Landis, who, let me just say that when I watched this film, I watched it at the very height of COVID. So just 3 years ago, it was the first time I had ever seen this. I had always wanted to check it out. What I didn't realize was that it was going to... I thought it was going to be a straight-up horror movie. But it was definitely very comedic. But I have to say, when this film is really terrifying, it's really terrifying. To go into the comedic side of it first, there's a lot of great jokes bouncing back and forth. Obviously, when you have a filmmaker like John Landis behind this film, who was so big at the time with all of his comedies, Animal House, and then he also did... what else did he do? Did he direct Beverly Hills Cop? Did he do that?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop, all these Eddie Murphy comedies, Blues Brothers, he did that. So he was like Coming to America, a lot of Eddie Murphy comedies in the 80s. But American Werewolf in London was just so interesting for him to do because he brought comedy, but then all of a sudden he injected this horror element to it. These two guys going to London, exploring and everything. And then this werewolf comes about, kills one of them. And then the other one is like, what the fuck is going on? What's happening? I don't understand what's going on. And let me just say that it does what it needs to do as a comedy. It makes you laugh. It does what it needs to do as a horror movie. It scares you. But when I saw the movie and you see that jaw-droppingly incredible transformation sequence that honestly still holds up very well, I was really surprised by how terrifying and looked and how really impressive the prosthetics and the makeup. Rick Baker is a genius. He is one of the greats. It's sad that he's no longer working anymore, but obviously with the state of where prosthetics and makeup are, you know, I totally get his reasoning for retiring and stepping away from the business. But the makeup work here is so freaking incredible. It's really impressive. And you know, it made me not want to go to London for a little while. I was like, am I going to come across a werewolf? And, you know, I got shook when just being like, oh, hey, Griffin Dunne is dead and he's talking to us as if he weren't dead. Then all of a sudden it would cut to him and there's blood all over the place. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty powerful stuff. Yeah, American Werewolf in London is really, really great. I was pleasantly surprised when I checked this movie out. I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it, but I watched it and I was like, I really wish I had watched this sooner because I was really, really impressed by what John Landis was able to do. And please don't remake this. There was a report a while back saying that his son, Max Landis, who should never work in the business ever again, that he was going to be writing and directing a remake to this. Let's not let that happen, please, and thank you. So, An American Werewolf in London is my number five. Are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
It's funny. This is actually my number four.
Ooh. So, why is it your number four?
It is the first true horror film that I ever watched. I watched it at 13 years old on my dad's couch because he said, no, you have to see this, that, you know, like, I know you love scary things. I know you love funny movies. He knew he had a sort of sense of what I could handle. And we watched it in broad daylight on my dad's couch. And I kind of remember having the realization of, this is what I've been missing with scary movies, like this incredible storytelling with scary movies. And like you mentioned, the Rick Baker special effects sequence on that first transformation, you know, it's all in camera, it's all practical, which I think is the reason that it holds up as well as it does. And you are right, he won the first ever Oscar for best, I can't remember if it's best makeup or best special effects, it's one of them, but he won the sort of inaugural Oscar for that, which speaks to how insanely brilliant that makeup is. Not only the makeup on the werewolf itself, but the makeup on Griffin Dunne, because if you're not familiar with this film, obviously the two, David Naughton and Griffin Dunne go hiking in the, you know, moors of England, and Griffin Dunne gets taken down by a werewolf, and so you see him kind of appear to David Kessler as a hallucination throughout the film. And it starts off, he appears, he's in his jacket, and, you know, it's just that slash across his face. But then over time, he degrades and degrades and degrades until David's sitting in a porn theater in Piccadilly Circus in London, and it's just this kind of maquette puppet of, you know, of his friend talking to him, and he's this corpse, and it's just, it's morbidly beautiful how great those both prosthetics and obviously this full body mannequin were. But yeah, the American Werewolf in London was my entry point to horror in general, but also horror comedy. And I think it, like Lost Boys, I think is a little less funny than some of the other things on my list. You know, it doesn't lean as hard into the comedy, but it's so atmospheric. You know, I lived in London for about 6 months back when I was studying abroad, and it's funny now, if you go to Piccadilly Circus, the, like, porn theater where the, you know, last act of the film starts is now, like, a Boots pharmacy or something, so it's, you know, it's a little more sanitized now, but, you know, it's the atmosphere that John Landis evoked, both just of England and London in the 1970s, 80s specifically, was such a specific, you know, air to it. You know, he really captured that really well, but he also captured a horror film that has a unique voice, because I think historically werewolf films are a lot more difficult to pull off than vampire films, because obviously the advantage of a vampire is that they can, even in their most monstrous form, fit into a humanoid version of society. You know, they can mask themselves a little bit better, whereas werewolves, it's harder to incorporate that without it turning into a straight monster film, because I think a lot of werewolf films now do try to deal a lot with the humanity. I mean, we obviously saw Marvel take a stab at it with Werewolf by Night last year, which is probably one of the better werewolf things that's come out recently, but it does a werewolf film really well, and I'm not a big werewolf person. I think, obviously, I tend to prefer vampires, but I think there's something so, like, I think that to credit the fact that it's all practical, that the wolf is practical when David Kessler finally kind of transforms, and, you know, you have that sort of tragic ending where he gets shot. But, you know, I think the credit to be it being practical makes it as monstrous as it needs to be, you know, because I think a lot of modern werewolves, you mentioned Twilight, tend to go with the CG route, and then it kind of makes them a little more human, and it's a little less, like, it's a little less scary in that sense. You know, it happens to deal less with the monster sort of Jekyll and Hyde idea of what happens when we lose control. Like, David has no control over this, and he's fighting it the entire film, and that's where the sort of tragedy of it all comes into play. But yeah, it's obviously a landmark film, and I think I'm not immune to the landmarks of horror cinema. You know, I love Freddy, I love Jason, I love a good slasher, but I think American Werewolf in London, as far as monster films go, is the hallmark of werewolf films, I think, as much as Halloween is a hallmark of slasher films.
Definitely, definitely. 100% agree with you on that. And my number four is a completely different film from American Werewolf in London. It's Zombieland. Zombieland is my number four. This might have been the first horror comedy that I had ever seen. I remember seeing this right when it came out. I was 11 when this came out. I didn't see it in theaters. I didn't see it when it came out. But I remember when I was in sixth grade when this came out, my hair was really, really curly, to where I kind of looked like Jesse Eisenberg. And there were people that would come up to me and be like, "Oh, hey, Columbus." And I'm like, "Columbus? Like, what? I don't know what that means, but okay." And then I'm like, "All right, why does everyone keep calling me Columbus? What does this mean?" They're like, "Oh, they're talking about Zombieland." And I'm like, "Oh, well, I'll have to watch it just to see how it is." And then I watched it, and I couldn't stop playing this movie on loop for so long. I remember whatever service it was on at that point, I just played it nonstop, nonstop, nonstop. I would come home from school, and I'd be like, "All right, I'm going to go watch Zombieland," just because I was so obsessed with it. And the thing with Zombieland that works so well for me is that it's definitely more of a comedy than a horror movie. It definitely focuses more on the laughs and the scares. But what I find really impressive is that it is able to balance them both really beautifully. And you do get some moments that are utterly terrifying and kind of difficult to watch, because this was around the time that the zombie genre was making its big start. Like, this was before The Walking Dead came out. Like, we had already had Dawn of the Dead. We already had 28 Days Later. But the zombie genre back then wasn't what it is now. I mean, it kind of faded away for a little while. Like, The Walking Dead lost popularity. But then, obviously, it kind of reinvigorated with the recency success of The Last of Us. And what I love about Zombieland is that it wouldn't work as well as it does if it weren't for the four people that were carrying the film. I think all of them work off each other beautifully. I think the chemistry of all of them is really fantastic. Together and separately, I think they all give fantastic performances. Woody Harrelson as Tallahassee is like pitch perfect casting. I'm sure when Ruben Fleischer was cast in this film, he's like, Woody, just play yourself. And that's essentially what he was doing. He was essentially playing himself. And I have a friend that worked on the second one when they shot it, and she had talked about how Woody Harrelson was basically just himself when they would shoot the sequences for the second one. And yeah, I love Jesse Eisenberg as Columbus. Abigail Breslin as Little Rock is great, but my personal favorite of the cast is Emma Stone as Wichita. I remember watching this film, and this was my first foray into Emma Stone, and I was like, this Emma Stone chick, first of all, she is very gorgeous, and second of all, she is very, very talented, so I want to see more from her. And then fast forward many years later, she's an Oscar winner. It's absolutely insane. And one of my favorite things ever was when they released the first trailer for the second Zombieland. It was like Oscar nominee, Oscar nominee, Oscar nominee, then said an Oscar winner, Emma Stone. So I thought that was really funny how they were able to do that. But no, it's a really entertaining film. You love following these characters. You love following their journeys. When you learn some of their backstories, it's very interesting. And, you know, like, some of their backstories are kind of funny. But then you get to Tallahassee's backstory, and I'm not going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but it's honestly a massive tearjerker, because you think it's one thing, which is still sad, but then you find out the true crux of it, and then you're like, oh man. But then they find the way to inject a nice amount of comedy in it. They're sitting around playing Monopoly at Bill Murray's house, and he grabs the fake money. He's like, I haven't cried like that since Titanic. It's great. I love it. And speaking of Bill Murray, honestly, I think that might be my favorite cameo of all time in a film. I really straight up think that I haven't seen a cameo as funny as that one. That, to me, and I come tomorrow, my answer could change, but I really genuinely believe that there's been no cameo in a comedy or even in the film that has topped Bill Murray's cameo in the first Zombieland. It's so good, and I love the time that we spent at that house. I love how Tallahassee is like such a fan of Bill Murray. He's like geeking out about him, kisses his hand, and bows to him and everything. He's like, I've watched your film since I could masturbate. And, you know, jokes like that, like, honestly, it may not have words, but it's just so funny. The film holds up. It's one of the funniest films I've ever seen. One of my favorite comedies of all time. I truly, truly love Zombieland. Never gets old. It's crazy that it's almost 15 years old. It's absolutely insane. I remember being like, just the time when this came out and how everyone was talking about it, everyone was watching it. Then, you know, you fast forward and the sequel came out, and then COVID happened, unfortunately, like immediately after the sequel came out, which is kind of crazy to say that. But yeah, I love Zombieland, and yeah, I don't know what else could be said that hasn't been said already about this movie. It's my number four. I love it so much. Are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
This is not on my list, and I've admittedly only seen it a couple of times, but the times that I have seen it, I do remember really loving it, as well as the sequel. I think the sequel has one of my favorite sort of comedy characters of all time, and it's Zoe Deutsch playing a dumb blonde. But the first film, my mom really loves both Zombieland films, and I'm not personally a big zombie person. I think it's the one kind of big monster trope or monster archetype in horror that it really kind of squicks me out. I think it's a little too close to home, I think, which is why I put off watching The Last of Us for so long. And then, you know, I waited and let it emotionally destroy me once I could binge it a little. But so Zombieland does what few zombie movies can't, or TV shows or whatever, can do for me, which is sort of inject enough between the concept of zombies and the actual plot to sort of make it more fun for me to watch, you know, and because a lot of it is, so much of it is less about the zombies and more about the characters. I think that's when zombie films really are at their best. I mean, obviously you have like Night of the Living Dead, which is George Romero, who completely revitalized the genre, things like that. When they're character focused, I really do love them. And Jesse Eisenberg, Woody Harrelson, Emma Stone, that's such a, you know, that's such a great combination of people. And I miss when Emma Stone was doing straight comedies like that. Like, between that and Easy A, you know, when I was in middle school, those were the shit growing up. So I please, Emma Stone, go back to comedies, because I'm begging you for a third Zombieland movie.
Yeah, we need Emma Stone to do another. Like, honestly, that period was just so great with her with comedy, because she did back-to-back, get ready, The House Bunny, Zombieland, Easy A, and Crazy Stupid Love. Literally all good back-to-back. Lord. Like, all back to back, pretty impressive. I'm happy that she's on this road of like starring in these Oscar caliber films. I'm very happy for her, but I would love for her to go back to do like a straight comedy. Like, the fact that Jennifer Lawrence has that comedy coming out very, very soon, it's just so exciting. Yeah. That she's doing that and everything after doing all these awardsy type of roles, and now she's doing a hard R comedy, and it's like, this is great that we're seeing her do something like this, especially now in her career. And I'm hoping that Emma Stone gets back to that path very, very soon.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure.
And now going into our number threes, what is your pick?
My number three film is a film that is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. We share a birth year. It is 1998's Bride of Chucky, directed by Ronnie Yu. It is the, I believe, fourth film in the Child's Play franchise, and it is the first to star Jennifer Tilly as Tiffany Valentine, who honestly, in my opinion, is one of the greatest horror villains in film history. I think Child's Play is a franchise that I really love. It's probably in my top two slasher franchises, because I love a good slasher. You know, it's one of my favorite sort of subgenres within horror, because I, like I said before, I really love A Final Girl. I really love, you know, somebody making it out alive to tell the story. But the Child's Play films are so inherently batshit just based on their premise. Even the original Child's Play, which was a bit more serious, you know, it had Chris Sarandon in it. It was a little bit more serious, but it has always been very hyper aware of the fact that this is about a serial killer who voodoo magicked himself into a fucking children's doll. So, like, it knows what it is, and I think Bride of Chucky is kind of where the franchise fully leans into it, because it is obviously the precursor to what we see in Seed of Chucky, and obviously the television show, which heavily features not only Brad Dourif as Chucky, but also Jennifer Tilly's Tiffany Valentine in a whole lot of body swapping shit. But this was, admittedly, I watched this before I think I watched the first Child's Play, just because I wanted to see Jennifer Tilly, because if you are of my age, you probably remember her not only from the Child's Play films, but also from the 2003 Eddie Murphy Haunted Mansion film, where she played, yes, Madame Leota. Yes. So I fell in love with her in that, and I adore her in this. And I think part of the reason that this makes it so high on my list is solely because of Tiffany, because I think up to that point, the Child's Play films had been getting slightly repetitive. You know, you can only have killer doll doing shit with a knife so much before it gets boring, which kind of leads into one of the greatest jokes in horror comedy history, which is Tiffany looking at Chucky going, "Stabbings went out in the 70s with Bundy and Dahmer. You look like Martha Stewart with that thing." And he goes, "Who the fuck is Martha Stewart?" And it's just, it's one of my favorite jokes, because later on, Tiffany says something about Martha Stewart, and he goes, "Fuck Martha Stewart." And it's like, conceptually, it's not played as a joke. It's just so bizarre and so campy, and I think the best horror comedies lean really hard into camp, and I think Jennifer Tilly always has. I mean, Jennifer Tilly's been doing iconic roles, you know, she was in Bound and, you know, all that, and she's been doing amazing stuff since, but there's it's funny, this film also stars a pre-fame Katherine Heigl as one half of the couple that Chucky kidnaps to get a ride, because, you know, they make the joke in the Chucky series that now he can just fucking Uber everywhere, but, you know, he had to get a ride at some point to get someplace, because, you know, he has to get from place to place to kill people to try to once again get a body back, because at this point the good guy doll that he is living in is hacked up and gross and disgusting and has been stitched up a whole bunch of times. And that's where you get the kind of brilliant sequence of Tiffany trying to pull him out of that doll body and into the body of her, I think, like, ex-boyfriend or, you know, hookup or whatever who she's killed. And it goes spectacularly wrong and she ends up in a doll. And you would think that two dolls, you would think the two killer dolls wouldn't work. You know, you would think it's just like you're jumping the shark, you know, before the shark's even in the fucking water. But you're not. And somehow it's the most insane, you know, expressive performance from a doll. And I credit that a lot to Alterian Studios, I believe is the name of the special effects company that did a lot of the doll work on those films. If you're not familiar with that, there's a documentary coming out called Living with Chucky by Kira Gardner. Her father worked on those films, and I'm very excited to dig into that. But there's, again, it's a lot of these films come down to practical effects for me, because horror can be made or broken by you know, effects. And again, like, I think if you were to do Bride of Chucky now, they would CG the dolls, you know, much like they've CG'd Annabelle or whatever. I'm not super familiar with new killer doll movies beyond Megan, but it's one of those things that it's of a very specific era as well. You know, the 90s were a weird time for horror. You know, this was kind of just pre or just post, I can't remember, Rob Zombie's Halloween films, which were questionable despite my love for Rob Zombie. But it was a very sort of different era, and I think if you had pushed this film in a slightly different direction, it would have kind of crumbled the entire franchise. But really, it managed to be, much like the new John Wick film that came out, somehow the fourth being the best one in the franchise, which is virtually unheard of, basically.
First of all, I'm so happy you brought up John Wick 4, because that is currently the best film of the year, and everyone needs to go see it if they haven't already, so please do yourself a favor and go see it. So, interesting story about this particular film. I've only seen the first Child's Play. I haven't seen anything past that, so I definitely need to sit down and get through this entire franchise, because I have been wanting to watch that TV show, and everyone keeps telling me the TV show's actually really good, and I'm like, really? It's actually that good? And everyone's like, yes, it's good. And I'm like, okay, I guess I have to go through all these movies and everything, which is going to be a lot. But hey, we'll power through. We'll take care of it and everything. I just want to say, funnily enough, about this franchise, when the remake came out, and it came out the same weekend as Toy Story 4, my favorite was how the whole marketing was like, there was a knife, and then it was like Woody was cut off, and then Buzz's arm was decapitated, and all the toys were stabbed, and the fluff was all out of it and everything. I thought that was really, really clever and good marketing on their part. But at the same time, it's like, why the hell are you remaking Child's Play? And no disrespect to Mark Hamill, but why are you casting him in the role? Like, why
he
him?
He could do so much better in a horror film. Please. But, like, because obviously we have Mark Hamill as the best Joker, and I will die
absolutely
on that hill.
Absolutely.
So please put him in something scary where he can use that to his advantage. Please.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's a cool idea, but it's like, it's just not, it's not Brad Dourif, you know, it's not, it's not him. So it's like, how could you make this work? But hey, to each their own, I guess. But hopefully we'll never have to see any more Child's Play movies like that again. Although it did star recent Oscar nominee Brian Tyree Henry, which is very, very cool. So,
oh,
you
my
know,
God, I forgot about that.
So, you know, all power to Brian Tyree Henry. If he wanted to do it for a paycheck, so be it. The man can do whatever he wants, however he wants. If he wants to phone it in, be my guest. He is Brian Tyree Henry, and he is a fucking king. So,
yes, he is.
my number three is Trick or Treat from 2007, directed by Michael Daughtry. This is another film that I recently watched for the first time. And, you know, my thing is I tend to watch a lot of these acclaimed, celebrated horror films way later than I want to. I will admit on air that I hadn't seen the first Scream until just a few months before COVID happened. Mm-hmm. So it was just a little over 3 years ago when I saw the first Scream for the first time. And I have to say, with Trick or Treat, I had no idea what to expect walking into it, because I remember seeing that poster so much of that child with that mask on, and that haunted me. That legit haunted me. And even as a grown adult in his mid-20s, that still scares me to this day. So naturally, when I sat down to watch it, I was ready. I was really interested. And I absolutely loved it. I think, first of all, it's hysterical like all these horror comedies are, but this is definitely one of the scarier films on my list. Like, this is actually a really terrifying film. And what I commend so much is how a lot of the stories tie in with one another. I think my thing with anthology stories is that they're mostly misses for me because, yeah, they're fun to watch. It's fun to follow these different stories. But after a while, it's like, what's the point? Like, what's the whole point of all this? But the fact that some of them tie together is really, really cool for me. And I think the entire cast does a great job. They knock it out of the park. I will tell you that after I watched this, I said to myself, I don't think I could ever watch Anna Paquin in anything ever again. Like, I always had pictured this Oscar-winning actor to just be, you know, the person that's in all these period things. Now, keep in mind, to anyone listening, I've not seen True Blood, so I'm not going to go off that. I've been told it's a great show and I need to watch it, but I'll watch anything with Alexander Skarsgård. So I went into the movie and I saw Anna Paquin. I'm like, oh, I feel like I know what kind of role she's going to play. And again, not to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't seen it, but let's just say that there's a particular sequence in the forest where Sweet Dreams are made of this dark cover of the song is playing, and she and her group of friends does something that kept me up at night, and it wouldn't leave my mind what was happening. And I think the stories are really, really cool. I think the film is paced so well. The film is actually super, super short. It's only 82 minutes long. This is a very quick watch. Like, it flies by super quickly. I could have watched way more minutes of it. And I always found the story behind this film to be really interesting because it premiered at a festival in 2007, but there was a lot of issues with getting it backed up, and I don't know exactly what had happened that caused it to constantly get delayed and delayed over and over again. But finally, like 2 years after it was supposed to come out, it finally got released on home video. It garnered this huge cult following. A lot of people celebrate this film. They watch it every Halloween. They've been wanting Michael Daughtry to make a sequel to this. There have been reports saying that he might be working on a sequel to this. We'll have to see. Fingers crossed. I would literally kill for a sequel to this. This is one of the best horror films of the 21st century so far, in my opinion. And mainstream horror films, I tend to like the independent horror more than the mainstream horror. But this is how you do a studio horror film. It's scary, it's thrilling, it's thought-provoking, it's hysterical. And again, Anna Paquin, you will never see her the same way again after watching this film. You will watch this film going in with one perspective, and then you see this and you're like, I can never picture her in anything else again. Because I rewatched The Irishman not too long after seeing this movie, and I'm like, oh, now I'm traumatized every time I see her on screen because I just think of what she does in Trick or Treat. It's so good. And, you know, Michael Daughtry's no stranger to horror comedy. He later went on to make Krampus, a film that I actually think is criminally underrated. I think that film is so, so solid. Wasn't a fan of his Godzilla movie, but that's not a horror comedy. So maybe it is to some, but not to me. And if it was a horror comedy, it failed tremendously. So Trick or Treat is my number three. I love this film so, so much, and I highly recommend it to anyone out there listening that loves horror movies, loves comedy. You need to check this out. Also, the kid from Bad Santa's in this, and what happens to his character? Absolutely nuts. So, Trick or Treat, are you going to pass, or is this not on your list?
This is not on my list. I actually haven't seen it. I know a little bit about it, though, because it's funny that you say that little baby Sam scared you, because he's the only thing I know about this film. And even Sam's mask, I think he's like adorable, which probably speaks to, you know, some fucked up thing in the back of my mind. Like, I love a little creepy little gremlin boy, and little baby Sam is very cute to me. But I know nothing about sort of the other anthology parts of it, just him, because I see him in people's yards at Halloween time, you know. Mm-hmm. So he's just cute to me. That's my only thought on that film.
Well, if you ever watch it, your whole perspective is going to change. Just to let you know, it's going to change completely.
Yeah, probably. I mean, but, you know, I'm a big fan of slashers, so God knows. I'm in love with Candyman, so we'll see.
Candyman is a very good film. Not a horror comedy, but it's a very good film for sure. Very the good original. Film, we're yeah. talking about the original. The original is very good.
The Nia DaCosta one's good, too.
I wasn't super big on that one. I'm very disappointed. I'm a Nia DaCosta fan,
so that's probably why.
I do like her. I'm excited to see what she does with the Marvels. I'm hoping for the best with that. Same. But yeah, I mean, we'll talk about Candyman 2021 off air. I don't want to get into a rant right now. All right, so now we get into the top two, and this is very, very interesting for sure. Now, one of these films is one of my all-time favorite films. The other one is a film that is slowly becoming a possible favorite of all time. Not my absolute favorite, but a favorite of all time. So, what is your second favorite horror comedy of all time?
My second favorite horror comedy of all time is the 1988 film Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, starring Cassandra Peterson as her horror host personality. This is probably the most straight comedy of all of my offerings, because obviously Cassandra Peterson started off at Second City in LA. She was a comedian first, and then, you know, Elvira just kind of happened to her, you know. But Elvira, much like Morticia Adams, much like, you know, all of the other icons of 80s horror, Lydia and Beetlejuice and things like that, she very much stood out to me as a young sort of developing woman getting really into horror, because again, horror comedy, she was easy to get into because I could watch her show without being too terrified. And I grew up on Mystery Science Theater, so it was kind of a natural shift from Mystery Science Theater to Elvira's, you know, macabre. I can't remember the name of the television show, but the film sort of imagines Elvira as a real person who goes to collect the will of her, like, great aunt in this really uppity New England town, and then obviously shit goes down when she gets there and things go awry, and there's a man who thinks she's more powerful than she is, and she steals somebody's dog and turns it into a punk rock dog. It's very, very cute. But this film, I always joke, has my second favorite Bob in a film. It's Daniel Green as Bob Redding, next only to Lewis Pullman's Bob in Top Gun Maverick, but he plays her sort of himbo love interest, which is incredibly funny because it's one of the first films I remember seeing where it really was like strong, powerful woman and this kind of bimbo of a dude. And it's so much fun. It's so very obviously shot on a back lot. I've been to the back lot where it was shot. It was shot partially on the Warner Brothers lot. I got to see a chunk of that one. I visited a friend in LA a couple years ago, but it has, again, one of my favorite jokes in a comedy, which is when Elvira pulls up to this town. She's got all black and leather or cheetah print on. She's got this black, I think it's like a Mustang that she's driving. So she's very obviously not like the conservative sort of members of this town. And Edie McClurg, who's one of the best sort of comedic supporting actors of the 80s, is kind of giving her shit because she plays this sort of PTA mom town leader who doesn't want her there. And so she's ranting and raving, and Elvira, who has, you know, 2 foot tall hair, and Cassandra Peterson's already like 5'11", looks up, kind of pulls her sunglasses down, looks down at her, and goes, "Sister, if I wanted your opinion, I'd beat it out of you," which I used to have on a sticker on my laptop for years. And it's very camp. It's probably, I guess not probably, but it probably is the least sort of successful of the films on my list. You know, it's high camp. It's very, you know, it's kind of cult favorite. There were, I believe, one more Elvira film was made in the 90s. But having read about the making of this film in Cassandra Peterson's autobiography, it seems like it was a really fun film to make. And I adore, you know, I am the biggest fan of high camp. I am the biggest fan of 90-minute movies, and I'm the biggest fan of badass women. The three of those are all wrapped up in this film. So it's kind of structurally perfect for a person like me.
I have actually never seen any of her films. They're massive blind spots for me, and I've heard mm-hmm. that they're so much fun, and they embrace the campiness, and they're very badass, like you said. And Cassandra Peterson's story is really, really fascinating, because I do remember when that autobiography came out recently, and just her talk about her life and everything, and her relationships and her career. I just found it so fascinating and made me want to delve into her career. So hopefully very soon I could sit down to watch these films, because they sound really fun. They sound campy. They sound over the top. And I love myself a good over the top campy film. And I'm also a sucker for 90-minute films. Although I do appreciate every once in a while the very long film, i.e. John Wick Chapter 4. So I love myself a good short, breezy film. And yeah, I definitely will check that out now based on your recommendation.
Fantastic. I hope you do, because it's I always say, you got to go into it knowing it's going to be supremely stupid, but like, that's the appeal of it.
Right. I love myself a good stupid film. And as soon as I check them out, I will let you know how I feel about them.
Amazing.
And my number two is another film that I watched very recently for the first time. I had put this film off for years because it just sounded like a film that didn't... I don't know how to describe it. It just looked kind of shitty from the trailers and everything. And even though I love the two lead actresses in the film, I really was not sure how this film was going to sit with me. Because I had heard all these reports for so many years of how the movie is stupid fun to some people. Some people think the movie is actually incredible. And some people think the movie is genuinely god-awful and should have never seen the light of day. But I watched it because I was randomly on the Criterion Channel one day. It was on Halloween 2021. I see this film on there and I'm like, am I going crazy or is this movie listed on the Criterion Channel? If it's on the Criterion Channel, then that must mean it's very, very special. So, my number two favorite horror comedy of all time is Jennifer's Body.
Yes. Yes.
I really have called this to be one of the most surprising films I have ever seen in my life. I watched the movie, and first of all, it completely surpassed my expectations by going in directions that I was not anticipating going. What I didn't realize that was that it was a comedy. I thought it was just like a young adult horror thriller type of thing. You know, Megan Fox, obviously at the prime of her career, she had done Transformers. Everyone was like, Megan Fox is the hottest person on the planet, blah blah blah. And then Amanda Seyfried was in there as well, you know, coming off the heels of the great Mamma Mia. So for her to go from that to this, what a trajectory. I love it so much. And this is definitely a very 2009 film. I can tell you that right now. The music alone is very 2009. The casting in this movie alone is very 2009. Like, other than Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried, you have Johnny Simmons. Do you remember how Johnny Simmons was, like, in every teen movie that came out during that time? Like, he was in this. He was in Scott Pilgrim. He was in Perks of Being a Wallflower. He was in that. So it's like, he was all over the place, that kid. And now, I can't even tell you the last time I watched him in anything. And Adam Brody, I mean, he had just come off doing the OC. And, of course, everyone's like, oh, my God, the OC. Seth Cohen, oh, my God. The fact that I know his name is ridiculous, but also, granted, I have his Wikipedia pulled up right in front of me, so that's how I'm able to know his name on the show. But no, I was genuinely surprised by how much I love this movie because it's absolutely hysterical. First of all, I laughed so much throughout this movie. Like, oh, there's a midnight showing of Rocky Horror tonight. Would you want to come? I don't like boxing movies. I love that delivery so much. She's, I don't like boxing movies. It's just so good. Like, I could easily picture someone being like that. They could mix up Rocky Horror with Rocky and everything. But also, Megan Fox's performance is genuinely incredible in this. She is fantastic. And I feel like a lot of people undermined her acting chops because, unfortunately, when you're in a Transformers film, I have a soft spot for them. I enjoy them. Are they bad? Yes, but I have a good time with them. I can recognize that the acting in them is not the best. But I always had a thought of when, if Megan Fox was handed a good script and was working with a good director, you could get a really solid performance out of her. And she is really, really great in this. Obviously, she's gorgeous and so beautiful. But I also think there's a lot to her performance that makes it stand out from so many other performances that we've seen in these teen horror comedies, what have you. There's a lot of vulnerability to her. And there are sequences where you're legit not only scared of her, but you're scared for her. And that's a hard thing to pull off really, really well. And she does a great job. And Amanda Seyfried, too, I think is fantastic in this. Amanda Seyfried has become one of those actors that I think is very underrated and very underappreciated. Of course, everybody knows who she is. She's a popular person. She's an Oscar nominee, for goodness sakes. It's so crazy to me that just saying Oscar nominee Amanda Seyfried, I'm still just shook up that someone from Mean Girls, other than Rachel McAdams, is an Oscar nominee. I just think that's insane. Hopefully down the road we get Megan Fox to be an Oscar nominee so that we have the two leads of this movie be Oscar nominees together. We need that to happen. Could someone please write Megan Fox an Oscar caliber performance, please? Let's make that happen. Although she should have been nominated for this, and I'm not even joking when I say that. This was a fantastic performance. Now in terms of the horror elements, I mean, this film is fucking terrifying. Honestly, oh, yeah. it really crawls under my skin in ways that I wasn't anticipating it to. And that's a really impressive feat on, I hope I don't butcher her name, Karen Kusama.
Yes.
Is that her name? Yeah. Karen Kusama, who directed the hell out of this. She was really great. But my favorite aspect of this movie was the Diablo Cody script. I think it's sharp, it's clever, it's witty, it's thrilling. Again, it balances the horror and the comedy really, really well. And this was the first film that she did. I believe this was the first thing that she did after winning an Oscar for Juno. So, you know, you have the Oscar-winning writer of Juno writing a horror comedy. And she knocked it out of the park. Now, when this movie came out, it got very mixed responses. A lot of people praised the performances, but also a lot of people were expecting to go in, expecting this completely different movie because all the market was like capitalizing on Megan Fox's success and her beautiness and her popularity. But then you get this kind of movie and everyone's like, what is this? This is not what I signed up for. But in the past couple of years, it's garnered this huge following and huge cult following, and it's been regarded as a feminist cult classic. And it genuinely is a great movie, like not just a great feminist cult film. I think it's a great film. I genuinely believe that this is a great film, and it does everything well that it should do, and I really don't know why I slept on it as long as I did. I guess I was expecting one thing and got something else, and I remember watching the trailer after I saw the movie, and I'm like, wow, Fox really did this movie dirty. Whoever was in charge of marketing this movie, they should have been – I hope they were fired as soon as the movie came out. I really genuinely hope that they were fired because – you really fucked up the legacy of this film. This film could have had a much stronger impact when it came out. But I'm glad that now in the coming of years, everybody's loving it. Everybody's appreciating it. Everyone is seeing how great of a film this truly, truly is. So Jennifer's Body is my number two.
Yeah, that is not on my list, unfortunately. But Jennifer's Body is definitely one of the films that I consider part of my feminist film education. You know, obviously this is a feminist horror classic. And I think, obviously, like you said, the big strength of it is Megan Fox playing into what people expect of her, you know, because at the time she was known for Transformers, she was known for playing very sexualized Bond girl adjacent roles, which I don't think was her fault. I think that was entirely the fault of Michael Bay, but that's a conversation for off air. But so she knew what she had, and, you know, I think she was intelligent enough to really capitalize on that and really help use that to assist in this kind of performance, because this performance is very much informed by not only the character that Diablo Cody wrote, but Megan Fox's star status, because even despite Mamma Mia having come out, I don't think this film really cared all that much about Amanda Seyfried. Not that she's not fantastic in it, but it was really centrally focused on Megan Fox, who I do believe, I hope we see more of her in film. I hope she gets to make a bit of a comeback, because like, for me as a teenager when I saw this film, it was pretty fucking revolutionary, especially coming from an all-female creative team. Obviously, we have Karen Kusama directing the shit out of this movie. It's so, it fits into such a specific period of horror, of kind of, I don't want to say exploitation horror, because that's not what this is, but it kind of smacks of that a bit, and it's obviously, There are a lot more feminist messages than I can sort of pick apart in a short podcast episode, but it is definitely one of the ones that if you haven't seen it, I always sort of gently shove people towards it, because I feel like if you haven't seen it, it's kind of a gap in your horror education, especially feminist horror.
I also could never look at pools and community pools ever again the same way.
Yeah.
Like, yep. You know, I thought It Follows traumatized me for a little bit when it came to community pools. This might have traumatized me even more.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. If you're not, then there's something wrong with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now we get to our favorite horror comedies of all time. I am so curious to hear what your number one favorite is. So I would love for you to tell me and the people listening what your favorite horror comedy of all time is.
So my favorite horror comedy of all time is probably something that most people have never heard of because it is also quite a recent discovery for me. It is a 1987 film directed by Deborah Brock called Slumber Party Massacre 2. It is the sequel to a film called Slumber Party Massacre, and it's kind of a loose sequel in the sense that the first one was about a group of girls who were terrorized by a slasher called the Driller Killer, and it's obviously this very phallic killer coming after them with power tools. And that one's a much more straight, kind of serious slasher, but the sequel follows one of the younger girls. So they're the most of the girls in the first one were about college age, and then there was a younger sister who was 13, 14, and in Slumber Party Massacre 2 she is now adult, or she's 17, 18, she's sort of high school age, and she is kind of still living with the fear of that. She's got a little bit of PTSD. Her sister's in a mental hospital for it. It's a whole big sort of emotional deal, but she's in a band with her friends, and they decide to go up to this kind of newly opened condo for the weekend, and the young girl's PTSD has been manifesting in dreams of a version of the Driller Killer, who is now not this sort of creepy, sort of pedophilic-looking man, but rather a very young Atanas Illich as this sort of rockabilly rock star Driller Killer, whose weapon is a massive, massive red guitar, whose stock, instead of being an actual guitar stock, is a massive drill. There are obviously phallic implications there that I'm not going to talk about, but he terrorizes her in her dreams, and as they go out to this condo and play and, you know, invite guys over and have the, you know, general whoever has sex first dies first in a slasher kind of time, the dreams start to manifest as reality, and until we get to a point where the Driller Killer has reached reality, is now killing her friends, is now after her. It's a kind of an exploration of, you know, coming into sexuality as a young girl. But the thing that makes it a horror comedy is that this is the highest camp film I think I've ever seen. The rockabilly aspect of the new Driller Killer, played by Atanas Illich, who was in this and one movie and nothing else. He was some kind of nepo baby rich kid that, you know, did this for the hell of it. He is dressed in what one of my coworkers once called a 1980s John Bernthal outfit. And he, at one point, when he's on a rampage trying to kill all of these girls, stops, rockabilly, like, Elvis-style music starts playing, and he is singing as he's committing murders. It's very Repo the Genetic Opera, but, like, so much worse and so much better at the same time. And it's very much a product of, you know, the slasher heyday of the 1980s, when everyone was saying, you know, we need to pump out as many slasher films as we can to capitalize on the success of Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween and all of those other films. But this had such a unique twist on it, partially, you know, due to the fact that both this and the first film were fully written and directed by women like Jennifer's Body. So it comes at it from this very bizarre sort of female gaze-y way, where the slasher is not only a slasher in the traditional sense, but it's also this sort of big metaphor for coming into your own sexuality, because obviously the Driller Killer is much more attractive now. He makes a lot of passes at the young protagonist about her being pretty, or like, we belong together, yada yada yada, which, you know, other horror films have done. We mentioned Candyman, that's a sort of big thing with Tony Todd's Candyman, but this does it in such a fun sort of way, and the kills are so spectacularly, like, gross in a practical effects way, because the drill on the guitar does work. So it's this giant, like, 3-foot-long guitar, and you see it drill into people, and then it pulls back, and it's got, like, what basically looks like lunch meat hanging off of it. It's gross, but, you know, it's the thing comes through walls, and, like, all the kills are so disgustingly phallic that it's obviously making fun of itself. But it is a film that not many people have heard of. It's very much a sort of cult classic, especially compared to the first one, and I just love it because it's stupid, and the first time I watched it with my best friend on a Discord voice call, and by the time we got to the end of it, we were so hysterical that we were crying tears of laughter, so.
Well, you sold me on it because now I have to see it myself.
It is truly the most insane movie I've ever seen. And it's great because it ends with, you know, she thinks everything's fine. She thinks that, like, you know, she thinks she's killed the driller killer. She gets kind of, she goes to lay down in bed with her boyfriend. And in one of my favorite shots in any horror film ever, he rolls over. But when his arm comes up, it's the arm covered in the, like, biker glove and leather jacket arm of the driller killer. And you're just like, oh, shit. And it's the best, like, closing shot of a horror movie ever.
Can't wait to watch it. I'm going to put it on the list, and I will definitely watch it this October. I that's now going to be a top priority come October. Yes, when I binge all these horror movies. So I'm definitely going to check that out. And my favorite horror comedy of all time is a very popular pick. A lot of people regard this as one of the best horror comedies to ever come out. We are just 1 year shy of its 20th anniversary, which is absolutely insane that this movie is going to be 20 years old next year. It is the start of an unofficial trilogy of films. Now, let me just say that all three of these films are completely different from one another. They're all different. They're all comedy, but they're all different kinds of comedy. You have a horror comedy, you have a buddy comedy, and then you also have a you have an apocalyptic comedy. So you may know exactly where I'm going with this, listeners, when I talk about this. So my favorite horror comedy of all time is Shaun of the Dead, directed by Edgar Wright. I love Edgar Wright so much. He's one of my favorite voices working today. I am a huge admirer of his craft. And Shaun of the Dead is one of the funniest films I have ever seen in my entire life. Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright's dialogue is literal music to my ears. I think they write some of the best comedy that I've ever heard. Like, all three of these films in this unofficial Cornetto trilogy of this Hot Fuzz and the World's End. A lot of my favorite comedic moments on screen are from these three films. And I think this film is absolutely exceptional because it is ridiculously funny. It is hysterical. There's so many jokes that when I was younger and I first saw this, they flew over my head. But somehow I still laughed at them, even though I was like, I don't understand what the... First of all, I can't understand a word they're saying because their accents are incredibly thick. Second of all, I have no idea what the hell they're talking about. And third of all, I don't understand the context of the joke. But as I got older and I started watching this again, I was like, man... This film is great, and it has one of my favorite introductions of all time, like the opening where you see the zombies walking and everything, but this was obviously before everything went down to the craziness that happens throughout the movie. And, oh my god, one of my all-time favorite monologues, honestly top 10 monologues of all time for me, is in this film when Sean is going through the plan of how they're going to go get Liz and his mom and then go back to the place. Like, it's just so incredible. Like, literally, take car, go to mom's, kill Phil, sorry, grab Liz, go to the Winchester, have a nice cold pint, and wait for all this to blow over. How's that for a slice of fried gold? It's so good. Yeah, boy! I love it. It's so good. It's so incredible. The writing is very sharp and clever and witty, and both Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are amazing. Like, they have obviously proven through later films that they work off each other like magic. It's like peanut butter and jelly. They go together so well, and I love their banter together, and they're so great separately too, especially Nick Frost as Ed. He is such a fucking idiot, and there's so many things that he does that are just ridiculous, like when he's playing games in the middle of when they're trying to go to the Winchester and everyone's like, Ed! And it's great. I love it so much. And then when they throw the albums, Batman album, throw it. it's so great. And the horror in the movie too is, you know, obviously it's very over the top and goofy. You know, obviously this is a much smaller film. It doesn't have the high caliber budget as a film like World War Z has with the zombies. And again, this was before the zombie craze became what it had become a few years down the road, because 28 Days Later we had at that point, and Dawn of the Dead also came out the same year, Shaun of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, like all these dead movies and zombies and everything coming out at the same time. But I really love the approach that Edgar Wright took to this film, and I think it wouldn't have worked as well if the movie wasn't very funny. This obviously focused more on the laughs and scares, but there are some moments where there's emotional gravitas to it, and you know, the friendship between Sean and Ed is really special. And yeah, it's funny on paper, but then you could genuinely just see the friendship that blossoms, not just through these characters, but through the performances of Simon and Nick working together. They're just so great. Like, I really hope that down the road, Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost work together on a film again. I know they've talked about trying to collaborate together again, but Edgar Wright is now doing his own thing by doing, you know, he did Baby Driver, and then he just did Last Night in Soho, which is not a horror comedy at all. That's like a straight-up horror film, which I really loved seeing him do. I loved seeing him go down that route, especially considering that he's always been a big fan of horror. He's always talked about how he wanted to make a horror film, and now he got the chance to do it. I know it didn't wow everybody. I was a really big fan of Last Night in Soho. I wasn't too big on how it wrapped up, but I really liked the approach that Edgar Wright took to it and the ambition that was placed into it. But Shaun of the Dead is my favorite horror comedy simply because it's the one that I've seen the most. It's the one that I laugh at the most. And even though it doesn't scare me as much as the films that I had brought up before, it doesn't scare me as much as American Werewolf in London or Jennifer's Body or Trick or Treat. Zombieland is definitely not as scary as this, in my opinion. But I just really love the movie. I can watch it anytime. And I think that this Cornetto trilogy is one of the best trilogies we've ever gotten, even though it's not an official trilogy. Like, all three of these films to me are three comedy masterpieces. Hot Fuzz is my personal favorite comedy of all time. And The World's End, I think, is way better than people talk about. I feel like that should get way more recognition than it already has. And I just love Edgar Wright, and I love his style and his camp and his ambition. And there are just some deliveries of lines in this movie that wouldn't work if it wasn't for how Edgar Wright edited it and then how the actors performed it. Like, there's a sequence where they're randomly just sitting on the couch watching the news, and all of a sudden Sean's roommate comes out of nowhere, and the way they scream, they don't even, like, get up. They don't even, like, go crazy. They're just like, ah! Like, it's great. I love it so much. I love Shaun of the Dead. It's fantastic. It is my number one favorite horror comedy of all time. So obviously it is not on your list for some weird reason. I will never understand that. I'm just kidding. So what is your take on Shaun of the Dead?
I love Shaun of the Dead. It was, ironically, I saw the Cornetto trilogy backwards. I saw World's End and then Hot Fuzz and then Shaun of the Dead, but like you, I am a massive fan of Edgar Wright. I'm very glad you brought up Last Night in Soho because I think it's one of the best horror films of the last 5 years. It's my preferred sort of Edgar Wright joint, but Shaun of the Dead is such a perfect, like, masterclass in comedy. I think Edgar Wright is incredible at pacing. I mean, if you watch any of his films, if you watch Scott Pilgrim, which has one of my favorite jokes of all time, the, Scott here? He just left, and he just jumped out the window. But, like, so his pacing with comedy is incredible, but his pacing in general is great. I mean, I'm also a massive fan of Baby Driver, and
that Shaun of the Dead won, is... That should have won Best Editing at the Oscars. It should have won Best Editing.
Yeah, but Shaun of the Dead is such a good... It is kind of... It's not on my list, I think, just because I saw it much later in life, but it is kind of quintessentially, if you're going to build a horror comedy, I think it's one of the ones that you should look to because the pacing is really, is there. The horror aspects of it are there, you know, the kind of creepy zombies are there. And like you said, just the editing and some of the sequences, it's got one of my favorite sort of quote unquote fight sequences in a film, which is the one in the pub set to Don't Stop Me Now by Queen. Mm-hmm. It's just one of the, Edgar Wright has the greatest, I think, needle drops in film history. I will die on that hill. Between that, everything in Baby Driver, the stuff in Last Night in Soho, he's got such a masterful understanding of pop culture in that way that really fits. And I think, yeah, the comedy duo of Simon Pegg and Nick Frost is one of the most unbeatable. And I think the thing that helps this film, I think if this film had been American, I don't think it would have worked as well. I think there's something absolutely very specific... None. There's something very specific about the very dry British humor of it all that sort of really ramps up everything that's happening, especially when you get such incredible actors. I mean, you have Nick Frost and Simon Pegg, but you also have, like, Bill Nye and Martin Freeman in there and Matt Lucas very briefly and all these other people. So it's this kind of motley crew, and it was the beginning of, not necessarily the beginning, but at the start of one of the most unique directorial careers in Hollywood. And I think it might not have ended up on my list, but I do have a deep love for it, even if Hot Fuzz is still my favorite of the Cornetto trilogy.
Well, Hot Fuzz is the best of the entire trilogy. And anyone that says otherwise is ridiculous, even though all three of them are masterpieces, in my opinion. But Hot Fuzz single-handedly is literally the best comedy I think I've ever seen in my life. And I could quote that nonstop. And I can't wait for the day where I get to talk about it on this podcast, because I am waiting for a day where someone says, hey, Brian, let's talk about buddy comedies. And I'm like, great, Hot Fuzz, number one. There we go. So before we get into talking about some of the films that didn't make our top five list, let's recap the list. So, Maggie, what is your list from 5 to 1?
So my list from 5 to 1 is The Lost Boys, An American Werewolf in London, Bride of Chucky, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and Slumber Party Massacre 2.
And to recap my list, coming in at number 5 is An American Werewolf in London, number 4 is Zombieland, number 3, Trick or Treat, number 2, Jennifer's Body, and number 1, Shaun of the Dead. So that is it with my list, and that is it with our list. Let's talk about some of the films that didn't make the cut. So Maggie, what are some films that you want to give a shout out to that couldn't make it into your top 5?
It was hard to sort of narrow this down because so many of the films, horror films that I love are horror comedies, but I think the big one is obviously Beetlejuice, because that was really, really formative for me. That was one of the first like scary movies I was ever allowed to watch. And obviously Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice and Winona Ryder as Lydia are two of the greatest kind of performances in the 1980s film canon in general. But I think that one, I think I was like, that's a little too cliche to pick. But I think the other one that I wanted to shout out was another sort of really underground film, because I have no capability of being a normal human being, and it's called Eating Raoul. It leans a little less horror, but it is about a couple played by Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenov who want to open a restaurant, but they don't have the money for it. And through some bizarre means, end up opening one through cannibalism. And it is such a bizarre cult film, leans very heavily into comedy that is barely works, but with the comedic talents of Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenov, who are, you know, cult film, cult horror icons, it really is one of another film that I saw quite recently, but it's one of my favorite films I think I've watched in the last couple of years. That was a quarantine watch for me. But it's so funny, it's so strange, and I really love it because unlike a lot of horror comedies where I'm enticed to watch it because it is fun or a fun prospect, I'm just so morbidly fascinated with this fucked up couple that really wants to open a restaurant. And I highly recommend watching that and then watching Chopping Mall, which is a slasher from the 80s, which also features Paul Bartel and Mary Warrenov playing the same characters.
I'm going to have to add so many of these things to my watch list. You're going to have to send me a list of like these horror comedies that I have to see. There's just so many. All these movies that you recommended, it's like, my God, I haven't seen any of them, but they all sound so fucking good, so I have to watch them now. For me, my honorable mentions list is pretty slim. There's not too many films that I could give a shout out to, but I would be remiss to not mention Scream, of course, because Scream is so iconic and celebrated. I love all the Scream films except for Scream 6, which I absolutely hated. I was so disappointed with it. I wanted to love it, but it did nothing for me, unfortunately. I don't want to go on a rant about it. It could have been so much better, and I'm glad that a lot of people are enjoying it, but this guy right here really didn't have any fun with it. The Cabin in the Woods is incredible. It's so fucking good, and I remember that was another film that I went into not having any expectations for, and I remember Thor had already come out, and I was like, this Chris Hemsworth guy, one, he is very attractive, and second of all, he is very talented. Ooh, he's going to be in a horror movie? Sure, I'll watch. And I loved it so much. And Drew Goddard, man, I love Drew Goddard, and I hope that he comes back very, very soon to make more stuff. Oscar nominee Drew Goddard, by the way, which is very, very cool. What We Do in the Shadows, Taika Waititi, masterful work, fantastic film. And shamefully enough, I have not watched the show at all, which is so disappointing for me to admit, because everybody loves the series. Everyone has said that it's incredible, it's great, it embodies what you love about the film and expands on it more. So I definitely, definitely need to sit down and watch that. There's just too much TV on right now for me to watch. I can't get to everything.
Oh my God, yeah.
They Live by John Carpenter, a fantastic film. Yeah. One of my favorite films from Carpenter. It's not my favorite, but in terms of like the not so big films like Exkun, Halloween, and The Thing, I would say They Live is like right under there. And Roddy Piper, God rest his soul, fantastic performance. Really incredible work from him. A lot of people were considering American Psycho to be a horror comedy, which at first I was like, I mean, it is darkly funny, but in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't know if I would consider that, but I'll put it on the list anyway because I love American Psycho. I did a great discussion on it on my Christian Bale episode that everyone should go listen to, and more details on that. And the last one that I want to mention, these are two massive soft spots for me. Objectively, they are not very good films. But in my head, I love both of them so much. Scooby-Doo and Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed.
Yes. My childhood.
My childhood as well. I feel so sad that I didn't put any Matthew Lillard in my top five because Matthew Lillard is an icon. He is a staple of my childhood. His performance as Shaggy is genuinely incredible. Not in the sense where it's like, oh, it's so bad that's good. No, it's a legit great performance from him. Mm-hmm. Like, the places that he went to like, disappear into that character, like, he nailed the voice. He nailed the attitude. He nailed the look. He nailed everything. Like, you watch Shaggy in the cartoons, and then you see Matthew Lillard bring him to life, and you think to yourself, wow, I'm literally watching Shaggy the way that I always pictured him being, and Matthew Lillard gave a genuinely great performance. And I always loved reading reviews of the original Scooby-Doo when it came out. Critics are like, the movie sucks, but Matthew Lillard kicks ass in this role. Yeah, you're right he kicks ass in this role. And I remember when I saw Scream for the first time, and I was like, oh my god, it's Matthew Lillard. Like, I literally got serious whiplash just seeing him in that. And I will go down and say that one of my all-time favorite deliveries in any film is when he screams, I feel a little woozy here! it's so great. I love it so much. I love it. I love both of the films. I can't say which one's my favorite. I love both of them equally. And I will admit on air that Linda Cardellini in Scooby-Doo 2, when she comes down those stairs, first crush I think I might have ever had. I was six when the movie came out. Like, literally her coming down and then the music plays. Who's your mommy? My mommy?
Yeah.
And it's so weird because jokes like that would never be in films like that that are aimed towards families. So I appreciate that back in the day when we were younger, those jokes would slide in movies, but now whenever you watch a movie that's a family comedy, they would never have jokes like that, or they wouldn't just work. But for some reason, these two still work. And I rewatched these movies at the height of COVID on Halloween with my friends. We all got together, we got some beers and everything. It was really, really great. And we always make jokes about Freddie Prinze Jr.'s delivery of when he looks at the camera as Fred going, I think Coolsville sucks.
Oh, yeah, those films are so, they were probably like the, much like Beetlejuice, the first couple scary movies that I was ever allowed to watch. And I had the honor of telling that to Freddie Prinze Jr. when I talked to him, which in hindsight, I was like, that makes you look like a dork. But, you know, those films were, because obviously, I think everybody our age grew up watching the cartoon Scooby-Doo. So I think it's sort of one of those natural continuations. And it's one of those things where it gets away with a lot of weird shit because it was originally supposed to be like an R-rated take on it. Because obviously, Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn wrote the script and then they toned it down to G. But so it got away with a lot of weird stuff. And it also got away with a lot of weird stuff because it was the early 2000s and we were getting away with... it was a very bizarre time for film where kind of comedy was shifting a bit. And so you kind of could slip things in that you probably wouldn't be able to now. But it was also just a lightning in a bottle movie because I feel like if you tried to do anything with a Scooby-Doo adaptation now, it would just be bizarre. And I think my brother and I were talking about how specifically the CGI Scooby in that film is such a remarkable example of how to do a CGI character well if you're adapting from a cartoon, because it's not meant to, that doesn't look like a real dog, but because it's stylized enough, it works. And it's one of the sort of better examples of how to use CG to your advantage when you're creating a character that is still stylized but looks like it can exist in the world.
And it embraces its ridiculousness and zaniness. It embraces it and it goes all out, which I really appreciate about these films. And there's a lot of jokes that, you know, you're like, I can't believe they got away with this in, like, movies for children and everything. But one of my favorite lines in these two movies, in the second one, this is tied for the most terrifying day of my life. Tied with what? Every other freaking day of my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and then Sugar Ray in the first movie. What the fuck was that all about?
I forgot Sugar Ray was in that movie. I completely forgot about that.
Like, what the hell was that? You could tell right away. You're like, man. 2000s. Ah, oh, great, great, great films. Before we close out the episode, our final thoughts on horror comedies. Like I said at the top, I love myself a good scare. I love myself a good laugh. When you combine the two and you give me a film like Shaun of the Dead or a film like Jennifer's Body or American Werewolf in London, all the other films that we talked about today, you did your job well. And I love a good horror movie. I do love it. But if you're able to make me laugh at the same time, you did a great job. So, I mean, I love a horror comedy. I don't know what else I could add. But, Maggie, do you have any final thoughts on this wonderful mesh of the two genres?
I don't think so. I think I've said everything, you know, that I wanted to say. But I do think that kind of combined all 10 of the movies we've mentioned, or 9 of the movies that we've mentioned, if you're looking to get into horror and it's not something that you're super into, or you think you're kind of a weenie like I am, I think this is a great sort of starting point, because it gives you a taste of what's to come in, you know, the Evil Deads and the Friday the 13th and all of that, without having to commit to the scare level. Because I know a lot of people like me who have anxiety kind of can't deal with it. But if you want a good start and you want to get into the genre and you want a starting place, start with these movies or hit me up, because I have a never-ending list of weird shit living in my head that I can give you.
Definitely, definitely. So, Maggie, it was such a blast to have you on tonight to talk to me about our favorite horror comedies. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So where could the people find you online? Where could the people find your work?
So if you want to take a look at some of my work, some of my professional work, you can find me as Maggie Bacella on Collider.com. If you want to follow me on socials, you can follow me at MaggieRachel_, spelled RACHAEL on Instagram. Maggie_Rachel on Twitter, MaggieRachel_ on Instagram. I get those two confused. On TikTok, just as MaggieRachel. And if you want to listen to my podcast where we dissect rom-coms, you can listen to Does It Get the Pass, which is streaming everywhere you get your podcasts. And you can follow that podcast on social media at Get the Pass Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You guys definitely need to go listen to that podcast. It's a really cool concept, and I love it so much. As someone who really loves rom-coms, it's a top-tier podcast that all of you should listen to, even if you're not a fan of rom-coms. I recommend that. You guys can follow me on all social medias at Brian Suffield. You guys could subscribe to the show on any podcast platform you're listening to. Rate, review, share this around. We have a Twitter and Instagram, so you can stay up to date with what's going on with this show. I really appreciate everyone listening. I seriously, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for listening every single week. Stay tuned. We have a lot of great topics coming your way, a lot of great episodes coming your way, lots of great guests. Be on the lookout for all that. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Film Fragments, and I'll see you guys for the very next episode. Take care, everybody.